Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of my Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Robert. It's just us today.
Just us today. No guests. We're kicking it old school, Jasmine and Robert style. We are going to talk about the gang bill and the status of that. Jasmine's going to talk to us about that. I'm going to talk to us a little bit about the budget and its travels through the Senate. And then Jasmine's going to talk to us a little bit about judicial restructuring.
Maybe a less exciting topic than the other two.
Yeah, maybe. I think it's important.
It's not quite as exciting, but it is important.
Yeah, and then we will finish out with quick hits, since it's just the two of us. We're doing it old school. All right, Jasmine, why don't you start off by telling us all about the gang bill?
Okay. Longtime listeners of my Old Kentucky Podcast should know that I am not a fan of the gang bill. We did a whole segment about it this time last year, but it did not get a vote last year, but now it's back, and it's worse than I could imagine it would be.
Oh, man. Is that because you have a small imagination, or, like, is it just super, super bad?
I just think it's really bad, and it seems to have a lot of support, so I'm really worried that they're going to have the votes for it this year.
Okay.
So this year's gang bill is House Bill 169. It's sponsored by Robert Benvenuti from Lexington and six other House Republicans. Benvenuti told fellow lawmakers that gangs pay attention to punishments in various states, and they target Kentucky because of its antiquated laws.
Interesting.
I have never heard of gang members coming to Kentucky for our relaxed penalties before.
And you would know because you deal with a lot of...
Right. Yeah. I've never heard of this.
Okay.
But the bill is estimated to cost $19.5 million over the next several years.
Wow. Is that mostly due to, like, increased enforcement or...
Increased enforcement, the cost of incarceration.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of things like that.
Okay.
So it's supposed to cost a lot of money. But here's what it does. So it makes gang recruitment a felony. So first degree gang recruitment would be a Class C felony. If you get charged with a subsequent offense, so let's say you've been convicted of gang recruitment in the past and you get a second offense, that's a Class B felony. That's 10 to 20 years in prison
for trying to
recruit someone to a gang. And so second degree is a Class D felony. And then third degree is a Class A misdemeanor. So it used to be a misdemeanor. Now it'd be a felony. And it could even be up to a B, 10 to 20 year felony.
Wow.
For a second offense. It also broadens the definition of a gang. So the current definition is an alliance, network, or conspiracy of five or more persons involved in a continuing pattern of certain criminal activity. So five or more, that's your number for what a gang is now. Here's what the new definition would be. Three or more persons who share a name or identifying hand signal or sign, colors or symbols, or geographical location or leader has been identified or prosecuted as a gang within the Commonwealth or another state or country and has two or more members who engage in or have engaged in a pattern of criminal activity.
Huh.
So that sounds really broad to me. It's just three people can be a gang, and I don't know about... you, but like in high school, I had like groups of friends, and sometimes we had like names for each other, and people had like handshakes and things like that.
Yeah.
Right?
If you had like a secret handshake with two of your good friends and two of them were like buying marijuana, then you would be in a gang.
Right. Yeah. That would be considered a gang.
Or,
so.
I mean, I think the joke, there's been some jokes said that like the University of Louisville board could technically be
right,
like
James Ramsey and the U of L board could be a gang under the new statute.
James Ramsey, Rick Pitino, and Tom Jurich could potentially be a gang. Absolutely.
Yeah, so this is really broad. Just hand signs, colors, geographical location. So this is I think that's a big one because a lot of these like supposed gangs that we have in Louisville are basically just neighborhoods.
Right.
People identify with a certain location or neighborhood, and sometimes to law enforcement that may be deemed a gang. The new bill would also broaden the definition of a criminal syndicate and make that three instead of five or more. And so a criminal engaging in organized crime in a criminal syndicate, that's already a Class B felony. And so now, before you needed five people for that. So an example of a criminal syndicate might be like a stolen car ring or
gotcha.
Even like an employee theft ring. If if you worked at a department store and you and some other employees were, you know, giving some discounts to people, things like that.
Or like the guys from Office Space when they were like skimming the money off the top of the corporate. Yeah.
Right. So just three people involved in a criminal syndicate, that's a Class B felony. So that's also a 10 to 20 year crime.
Wow.
Right. It also increases penalties for committing a felony while being in a gang. So just being in a gang and doing a felony, you can face increased penalties.
Doing a felony, and like you said, because the definition is now so broad, like basically you could escalate that if you wanted to, like if you're a prosecutor and felt like doing it, basically.
Right. So how the gang determination would happen if you wanted to increase penalties under this gang statute, it would happen in a post-conviction hearing. So if you have a trial, you get convicted of the felony, then you have another hearing. Basically, you can introduce just about any kind of evidence to show that they're in a gang. Social media pictures, like, so if someone has a picture of them throwing up some kind of hand sign, that could be your evidence. But they have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they are in a gang. So they get a second hearing for that. The bill could also change parole eligibility from 20% to 85%.
Wow.
So 85% time is no joke.
It's like all of it, basically.
Right. It's a huge jump from 20 to 85. So if you get convicted of a crime and you're going to serve 10 years, but you have 20% parole eligibility, you're eligible for parole at 2 years. If you have an 85% crime, which are usually only reserved for violent offenses, so like armed robberies, murder, things like that.
Right.
Those are the 85% crimes. So 85%, that's 8.5 years of your 10-year sentence before you're even eligible for parole. So that doesn't mean you get out.
I mean, that's a 425% increase. That's massive. That's
right.
Huge.
It also creates a cause of action for people harmed by gang members, and property used in the commission of a crime can be forfeited.
Okay.
So that was part of the bill last year. There are a lot of problems with this, but there's a lot of research out there that increased penalties aren't effective in deterring violent crime. So better deterrents include community programs, treatment programs, programming in jails and prisons and juvenile detention centers. And this is a really big one that you might not think about: affordable housing.
Oh, no. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
People can't afford to move out of the neighborhoods where the criminal activity is higher. And this is where a lot of your alleged gang activity happens. You know, someone lives in a bad neighborhood where a lot of people associate with a certain neighborhood gang. People can't afford to move, and that's how they get caught up in that, or law enforcement thinks they're caught up in that.
Yeah, I mean, affordable housing is one of the biggest markers of social mobility. Like, if you can afford a home, all kinds of stuff tends to start going right for you. And if you can't afford a home, like, then you start turning to other things. So, like, it's not surprising that if you have affordable housing, like, you're not as likely to, do crimes.
Right. At one time, a judge told one of my clients who kept having issues with, like, a person that lived nearby. She was like, why can't you just move?
Oh, God.
And that's not always something that people can afford to do.
Don't say who it is, but, like, when that person's up for election, let me know and I'll vote against them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Another problem, this bill could actually increase gang activity. If we're sending more people to prison, people join gangs in prison just to survive and get by.
Sure.
When people are incarcerated for long periods of time, they lose contact and their community ties. And so when they're released, the only people that they might know are people they knew when they were committing crimes or people that they met in prison.
The way that this law is written, too, if there is evidence of you being in a gang in prison and then committing a crime later, you could then add the escalation on for your, like, the prison gang you're in as, like, right.
Wow. I think the gang activity has to be, like, in the commission of the felony.
Okay. A lot of this is yet to be shaken out. I mean, this is kind of one of my bigger issues with all of this, is the way that it's written.
Right, and how is it going to apply?
Yeah,
it's tough.
It's going to end up just being in the hands of prosecutors and judges to, like, you know, they're going to try it. They're definitely going to try to do all this stuff.
This is how I see this working in practice. It could force people to take deals that they shouldn't take to avoid prosecution under the gang law.
Mm-hmm.
So the way we see this now with the PFO laws. So PFO laws are persistent felony offenders. people can face increased penalties if they have been convicted of a felon within a certain time of picking up a new felony charge. And so often prosecutors make offers or deals that involve pleading guilty to something to avoid the increased penalties from the PFO statute. That's kind of how I see this working. You know, you plead guilty as charged, take a deal, we won't use the gang statute.
Right.
So that's something that I could see happening if this passes.
What ends up happening is people, you know, admit to doing crimes they didn't just because they want to not have to go to prison for 85% of a 30-year sentence or something like that.
Right. Also, you know, I've kind of already mentioned this, groups that law enforcement consider gangs sometimes aren't really gangs. They're neighborhoods, they are families. They're kids who have a group of friends with a name or a handshake. I think that there are real gangs in Louisville, but I also think that a lot of them are just groups of kids that don't have supportive families that have turned to like older kids, and they call themselves a family. And it's also like neighborhood wars, not necessarily gang wars.
Right.
And I really think that all this will do is it will be applied in a discriminatory way.
Yeah.
And I think this is, it's just eroding all the work that we've done towards criminal justice reform with our felony expungement law, putting maximums on the time that juveniles can spend in detention, the bail credit statute, drug crime reform that we had back in 2011. This is taking away a lot of that and moving a little bit backwards to me. And I think number one problem is this will contribute to the mass incarceration of people of color. That is what this bill comes down to for me. If you have never heard about the problem of mass incarceration of people of color, you should read The New Jim Crow. That's some good reading material if right. you want to know more about that problem.
Yeah, Michelle Alexander, I actually have seen her speak. She's a very impressive person. Good book, yeah, for sure.
But Ashley Spaulding from KSEP has been kind of the big researcher on this issue. She testified that similar legislation in California overwhelmingly led to the incarceration of individuals belonging to minority racial groups, despite an increasing number in white people participating in gangs. Mm. And it was not effective in combating crime and may have even resulted in increased gang activity by promoting gang solidarity, antagonism to law enforcement, and gang involvement as a prison survival strategy, like I talked about
right.
earlier.
Yeah.
So where is this bill right now? So House amendments were proposed. Jason Nemes proposed keeping the number at 5.
Instead of 3, right?
Right, yeah. Which I definitely would support that. Not that I would still support the bill, but I think that would be a lot better than 3 people.
Right.
If we had just one more person here, Robert, we could be a gang if we decided to do a misdemeanor together or something.
Yeah, let's hope that Ben Carter doesn't come down from upstairs. Because he'd also be the person suggesting committing the misdemeanor. Yeah.
Attica Scott proposed including restorative justice provisions. Restorative justice is basically working with victims. It's kind of like a mediation. There's a lot of research that restorative justice really helps with rehabilitation and recidivism. And she also proposed an amendment that would require a racial impact statement, which would help in ensuring that the law is not applied in a discriminatory way. All of those House amendments were defeated.
Yeah,
though.
Right.
It passed the House 71-17.
Whoa.
So that means that several Democrats voted for it.
Uh-huh.
Attica Scott's probably been the most outspoken member of the House against the bill. She said, "I voted no on HB 169 because it is designed to lock up as many people of color as possible. And I voted no because $19 million, even over 10 years, is a lot of money to spend incarcerating more bodies."
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what this bill comes down to for me, is that we're going backwards, we're increasing penalties, and we're locking up more people of color.
Mm-hmm.
The bill is now in the Senate, and it has an emergency clause, so it would take effect immediately if it was passed.
Yeah, I believe it's sitting in the Judiciary Committee
yes.
right now, which Whitney Westerfield is the chair of that committee.
It had its first reading, and then it was returned to the committee.
Right. So
yesterday.
I think they have to have, 2 more readings before it can have a hearing. So, yeah, Whitney Westerfield's active on Twitter. He is a responsive legislator. He's good about that. So if you feel strongly about this bill, you should reach out and tell him that you would not like it to be heard. So you should do that.
You should do that.
Yeah. All right. Well, gosh. Okay. Well, we will be tracking that for sure. There's only 7 well, I guess there's only 6 legislative days left now. You know, so not a lot of time to get it over the finish line, but we will track it as it moves along. All right, Jasmine, let's talk a little bit about the budget. We've talked about the budget a lot. I think the last time we talked about it was 2 weeks ago, and we talked about the House passing a budget bill by a wide margin. There were several compromises in that budget. It restored funding to 24 of the 70 programs eliminated by Governor Bevin's budget. It restored some of the programs that saw significant cuts. And it increased revenue by adding an opioid tax and an increased cigarette tax. So we talked about that 2 weeks ago. But then the bill went to the Senate, and it has moved through there as well. On Tuesday, that would be March the 20th, the Senate passed their version of the budget bill out of the Senate Appropriations and Revenue Committee, and then later that night, they actually passed their version of the budget bill on the floor. The bill that passed through the committee, it got 13 yeses and 1 pass, and the pass came from Robin Webb. Pass just basically means, like, I'm neither voting yes nor no. Senators Morgan McGarvey and Gerald Neal voted to pass this bill out of committee, so they voted yes. Senator Webb voted pass because she said she hadn't had enough time to review the bill, which she'd only seen that morning. Then later on, the bill ended up passing the full Senate on a 26-11 vote, mostly along party lines. The overall vote doesn't really matter, as we'll get into that in just a second. So, okay, the Senate bill, what it actually is in the bill. The Senate bill keeps more of the 6.25% across-the-board cuts that the governor recommended. So the House budget, it had restored many of those across-the-board cuts to some things. The Senate budget, for example, keeps the cuts, the 6.25% cuts to higher education, while the House version of the budget spared the universities that massive cut. So the Senate budget, it also doesn't match the House's SEEK funding. It spends about $150 million less on SEEK funding over the two-year period that the budget will be in effect. So it doesn't fund education as much as the House bill does. The Senate budget does include spending for school transportation, which was one major cut in the governor's budget, which has received a lot of attention. There's no real, I've been looking around for this, there isn't really a publicly available version of the Senate plan, so I couldn't really check out how many of the 70 programs were restored by the Senate, but there were bits and pieces of this that were trickling out in the media. The Herald Leader report that the MISONET environmental monitoring station is restored in the Senate budget. The New Kentucky Project reports that the Kentucky Poison Control Center and the Kentucky Center for Mathematics were restored as well. The Senate, we talked a little bit about this last, or when we talked about the budget in the House, but they had to kind of split the budget and the revenue portions of their budget plan into two different bills. And the revenue portion of the bill was HB 366, and the Senate did not take up that bill. So we kind of expected that to happen, but the revenue bill that increased the cigarette tax and increased the opioid tax was not even looked at by the Senate. If the Senate doesn't take action on the bill, then whatever budget is adopted can't use any of the new revenue from those sources, and it's required that the budget be balanced, so they'd have to make do with the revenue that they could get otherwise.
And that's a big theme of everything we've been talking about this session is needing more revenue, and it seems like the Senate didn't even want to address that.
Yeah, though. it was very big for the House to actually do that. It was kind of it showed that the Republicans in charge of the House were, you know, listening to the massive amounts of people saying this. The Senate, though, as we've talked about also a lot this session, is substantially more conservative. It's a little disappointing, though, because when you split things up into two bills, which they had to do it like that, that's basically a way for the Senate to force the House's hand. You can't use that in any negotiations that are coming later.
Right.
Talking about pensions, that's a big portion of what the budget and what the whole process this session has been. The Senate budget includes $3.3 billion for pensions, like the House and the governor's budget. So all three budgets had $3.3 billion for pensions. However, the Senate's budget does some weird stuff. We haven't really talked about this much on this podcast, but if you're familiar with the budget or the way that pensions work across the state, there's several different pension plans. The teacher's plan is called TRS. There's KERS, and there's all kinds of different Kentucky employee retirement systems. There's the non-hazardous plan. There's the hazardous plan. There's several different types of pensions, and they all have different levels of funding. The Senate plan shifts a lot of the money out of the TRS plan, the plan for teachers, and into the KERS non-hazardous plan. The KERS NH plan, as it's called, it's only funded at 16%.
That's probably the lowest.
It is by far the lowest. I mean, if you were to take that pension plan away, Kentucky would be incredibly average across the country for the state pension funding levels. But because of this KERS non-hazardous plan, Kentucky shows up as the worst. That is the biggest problem. So the thing is, the Senate doesn't allocate any additional money. They just move money out of the teacher's plan, fund it less than the actuarially required contributions to the TRS plans, and moves a huge amount more than the ARC for the KERS non-hazardous plan into that plan. It's not really clear why they did this. And I've been racking my brain. I've been looking for smarter people to tell me why. I don't know why. It means that the TRS pension obligations are underfunded, and it basically just sets us on the same route to defund the teacher's pension for unknown reasons, and overfunding the KERS non-hazardous plan. I'm not quite sure why. We talked a little bit about fund transfers. Okay, that's another big issue with the budgets that we've talked about before. Fund transfers mean, you know, you have to have a balanced budget. Your expenditures have to match your revenues. And if they don't, you have to find revenue from somewhere else. And those are called fund transfers. And all three, the governor, the House, and the Senate budget, include fund transfers. The governor suggested $472 million in fund transfers. The House increased that number to $759 million, which that's a massive 60% increase in fund transfers. The budget splits the middle, suggests a number of $593 million, which is 26% higher than the governor and 22% less than the House. So really right there in the middle is what the Senate budget suggests. When we talked about fund transfers 2 weeks ago, we also discussed how the fund transfers were in large part coming out of the Kentucky Employee Health Plan. And that's particularly egregious because KEHP is an insurance plan, and excess money in the plan comes when people who are members of the plan pay in extra money that isn't paid out. So instead of using that plan for like a rainy day for if everybody, you know, we had a really bad flu year this year, but if everybody got sick with something, you know, you have to have that extra money to draw down on, or you could just return it to the members because mm-hmm. they paid into it. They aren't going to do that, and instead they're going to transfer that money to the general fund. Anyways, the Senate plan uses $310 million in transfers for KEHP, which is 53% more than the governor and 36% less than the House. So just like fund transfers overall, the Senate plan kind of splits the middle with the KEHP transfers. Okay, Jasmine, this bill, like we said, it has now passed the House and it has now passed the Senate. But as we've just been talking about, these are very different bills. So basically, all that's happened is that two pieces of the process have been completed. and now what needs to happen is a conference committee is going to be formed from members of the House and Senate, and they're going to hammer out what a final bill looks like. Whoever's on this conference committee, it will include people from both the House and the Senate, Republicans and Democrats from both chambers. They will discuss, negotiate, and come up with a final bill that then needs to be passed in both chambers. And then once that happens, we will have a budget as long as a governor signs it. Now, the governor, again, can do his line item veto and scratch out individual portions, but those vetoes can be overridden if the House and Senate leave enough time in the legislative calendar to override vetoes. So Tuesday, yesterday, the 20th, was day 53 of the legislative session. That means they have 7 more legislative days, not including today. So today, after today, they have 6. I'm not quite sure if they met today or not. They're obviously there. I don't know if they were meeting or not. So they either have 7 or 6 days to get this thing across the finish line.
And what this new Republican majority that we've had the last 2 years in the legislature, what they've kind of been known for is pushing some really big bills through at the end, like the charter school bill last year, and passing things really quickly without everyone really knowing what's going on sometimes.
Yes, Jasmine, that's absolutely true. But the thing is, that definitely did not start with the new Republican majority. That is something that has been true of the Kentucky legislature and legislatures across the country for a very long time. So, yes, but that is, it's bad no matter who does it, and it's bad that they're doing it now.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, well, enough about the budget. This is getting boring, I'm sure. Tell us all about judicial restructuring.
All right, so Justice Minton, that is the chief judge of Skokie.
Yeah, we're making it happen, Skokie.
And he's been asking for help with judicial caseloads for a while now. He's urged for a restructuring that would happen during the next circuit judge election year, which would be 2022. And he has a 10-point plan that he would like to incorporate for restructuring the court system in Kentucky. But specifically, he's requested extra family court judges in high demand areas. So Deborah Yetter of the Courier Journal, who she writes some really great law and courts pieces, she spoke with several judges who have some of the higher caseloads. Judge Vanover in Southeast Kentucky has the caseload of 2.68 judges.
Wow.
So he has the highest there are a couple in Northern Kentucky that have the caseload of about two judges, and Judge Spanauer in Bullitt County has the caseload of 1.5 judges. She said that she works 7 days a week, and she even takes cases home to review on the weekends.
Oof.
Which, me too, girl. The judges who were interviewed pointed the finger at the heroin epidemic for the increasing caseloads, particularly family court dockets where there are large dependency, neglect, and abuse dockets. Persistent poverty and mental illness are also other large factors that contribute to these rising caseloads in family court. But this is a big access to justice issue because people are waiting to have cases heard for months. And especially with family court cases, sometimes some of these issues need to be resolved much more immediately. If there's a safety concern for a child,
right.
You know, that's the biggest issue with family court dockets. On circuit dockets, it can also mean people sitting in jail longer awaiting trial. Senate President Stivers even suggested that if we didn't do something, this could turn into a federal claim because of the denial of access to justice.
Right.
In contrast to some of the judges that I talked about a second ago, the Jefferson County Family Court judges have the caseload of 0.99 judges, so right at one, and circuit judges are 1.15. So our caseload for our judges is a little bit better than some of the judges out in the state. And some judges in Eastern and Western Kentucky are only carrying about half of a caseload.
Huh.
So that's why Justice Menton wants to restructure and reallocate some of the judgeships and also add 7 new family court judges. But this is a really difficult issue because some counties would gain from this and some would definitely lose. And we have elected judges. So this is a super political issue as
right,
well.
Right, right.
A House bill was filed, though. House Bill 348 was filed to add family court judges in a few counties and make some other changes, but it's not quite as extensive as Minton's proposal. The bill was passed in the Senate today. It adds a few new family court judges, reallocates a few judgeships, and requires AOC, the Administrative Office of the Courts, to do an analysis on restructuring and determine the need for rearranging and reallocating. So, if that's signed by the governor, this law would become effective in 2019. So It's saying we're going to do a little bit now, but then AOC is going to do an analysis and figure out what we might need to do in the future and what the needs are. Because this is it's a really difficult issue for some counties. It's very political because of elections.
Right. I mean, and you don't want to lose anything. That's always
right.
Tough. Yeah.
Nobody wants to lose anything. But we have some judges with over 2 caseloads and some with only half of one. So
right.
Something probably needs to be done. This bill's been through the House and the Senate. So if the governor signs it, it'll be effective as of January of next year. But on a final related note, everyone in the justice system needs more funding to keep dockets running efficiently and people's rights protected. We also need more public defenders and even more prosecutors in some areas. I think this is posted somewhere in my office, but justice delayed is justice denied, and Damon Thayer said that today.
It's a pretty popular quote
in the
yeah.
Senate, right? And all parts of the justice system need to be funded to keep things running. So even if we fix this judicial issue, dockets still can't run efficiently if you don't have enough attorneys to do the cases. So that's judgeships are just one part of the issue with access to justice.
Right. Well, there you go. Yeah. So, I mean, what do you think? Do you think that this will get taken up in a bigger way next year? Do you think that the 10-point plan, judgment?
I think the AOC analysis is going to be done for 2020.
Okay.
So maybe after that.
Yeah. So the next judge elections aren't until 2022. So you could feasibly do it in any of the next 3 years, right?
And right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there you go. All right, Jasmine, are you ready for some quick hits?
Go for it.
Okay,
it's been
excellent.
A while.
It has been. Okay, Jasmine, the Courier-Journal ran a set of articles investigating and analyzing the Brady Industries deal struck by the Bevin administration and the legislature and the private company. So we've talked about this deal before on the show. It features the state itself taking an ownership position in the company, which is kind of unique across the whole country. This has not really ever been done before. The investigation by the Courier-Journal looked into the past of the CEO, Craig Bouchard. It's very interesting and worth your time to read to see kind of like what the man's about. Very interesting stuff. No matter where you come down on what you think about the deal, worthwhile to know that information. Okay, next up. After last week comparing teachers to people hoarding rations during war and saying that teachers were, quote, throwing a temper tantrum, Matt Bevin apologized in a 4-minute video on Facebook, which was very nice. He said he was sorry for any misunderstanding caused by his comments. So it was a little like, I'm sorry that you interpreted my...
Right.
That was the apology. But then one day after his apology, Matt Bevin said that teachers had a, quote, thug mentality for booing Joe Bowen. So I've seen the hashtag thug life around on Twitter a bit.
I have too.
Yeah, so
I enjoy that quite a bit.
Let's get excited for thug life. Our teachers living the thug life. Lastly, a Republican candidate for Secretary of State jokingly threatened to shoot Congressman John Yarmuth, who bragged about receiving an F rating from the NRA. Jokes about violence are never funny. I learned that lesson a hard way. So don't do that. If anybody does that, just don't make those jokes. It's not funny, and it causes people to be on edge, especially in the world that we live in. So there you go. Stay safe, Congressman Yarmuth. Everybody, thanks for listening. Jasmine, how can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter at @mylkypod. We have a Facebook page that you can like. Robert puts our show notes up on Medium, so you can check those out, and you can find our podcast on the podcast app of your choice.
All right, everybody, thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.
In your Kentucky home.